You know, I understand that all of us who are in public health, and especially those of us who are involved in working in the vaccine delivery business, we thought we were doing this because we wanted to protect babies and children and old people from devastating disease. Isn't that correct? Yeah, everybody, but especially, I don't know about you, I happen to love the old people. Well, nice to have the babies and the children at it too, but I always had a soft spot when I was working in immunization issues for adult immunization programs too, so I have to throw in the old people also. And that doesn't include us. Healthy adults, I guess I'm almost getting to the old. Yeah, I qualify, I think, even for flu vaccines. I'm part of that select group that actually gets to qualify for the vaccines now. Okay, anyway, but it's really kind of devastating, isn't it, when we know that what we're trying to do is to protect people, to save their lives, and we feel like we're bombarded constantly and questioned and challenged for the work that we do, that people are attacking us. I don't think that's too strong of a word, do you? No. And it ebbs and flows, but it seems like it flows a lot more. I have been at this, as Chris said, for a few years myself, and even though I've left the immunization arena, it hasn't left my heart. I continue to work around this issue because I am currently doing work around pandemic influenza, and as you imagine, we have a few vaccine issues associated with it also. And the recent events are really tough to watch as they go on. And they harken back to some of the things that I went through. I was there when we were struggling with issues of the DTP vaccine. I went through the RotaShield recall. And I was there when we switched from OPV to IPV. And even though that wasn't as much of an issue on the international stage, it was a really big event also. And I just want you to know that I understand just how difficult it is to try to go out there every day and do your job and have this cyclone of media and these questions around you, where your friends, your family, your patients, your clients are asking you, doubting you, questioning you, and you're still out there trying to do what you do. So I really applaud what you're doing. And we know that there are important things going on here. What I'm going to try to do this morning, in the very brief time I have, is to kind of explain some of the challenges from a perspective of communication, to give you a context of what it is that we're dealing with, some tools perhaps that you can use in terms of the psychology of what is happening here. I can't fix it. I don't have the magic bullet, just like we don't have the magic bullet in terms of vaccines. That's not what I'm here to do. But I can put this in context for you so that perhaps your level of frustration will just be reduced a little bit more as we go forward. Because I do think about this a lot. I do struggle with it. A lot of what I've brought into crisis and emergency risk communication for big events like a pandemic of influenza, I really learned through the work that I did around vaccine safety. So I do understand. I think that the first thing we need to discuss is that all risks are not perceived the same way. And if you think about it, what risks are parents perceiving when they come to have their children vaccinated? What's the risk? We think and focus on the risk as the disease, The disease is the risk. I think more and more, as we have successfully reduced the circulation of disease in this country, the focus is now the risk of adverse reactions from the vaccination. Think about that. So if we look at those things on the right-hand side of the screen, those risks are less well tolerated by the public. So anytime you have a risk or a threat that involves those things on the right-hand side, the public is less willing to accept them. Okay? So think about that. When something is involuntary, controlled by others, exotic, man-made, permanent, anecdotal, that means when there's a story, a person, versus a statistic associated with it, when it seems unfairly distributed and it affects children. Anything that you catalog on the right-hand side, if that occurs in the threat or the risk, people don't tolerate that risk very well. Now let's talk about the diseases that we're trying to fight. They're natural. They're fairly distributed, right? They do affect adults and children. But there's something that, you know, we have to understand when we're asking a parent to take an action to vaccinate their child, what are they weighing? The statistical risk seems to be the disease. It doesn't seem to be the risk from the vaccine, because it becomes real at the moment that you're getting the vaccination. So I think that there was a time when vaccinations were being given and the disease was circulating in the country, that it was a lot easier to accept the risk. But we've kind of turned it on its head, because we've been very successful in this country. Now, when we have outbreaks of disease in this country, for example, in San Diego with the measles, there may be a change, but not entirely. It's just our job is getting harder and harder. And what is perceived as the risk has altered in people's mind. And we know that in our health communication, we don't use fear as a means to bring people to action. So we don't stand up and use the scary stuff. We're running out of grandmothers who can even tell their granddaughters and grandsons about those diseases, aren't we? We don't have people who know about these diseases in this country anymore. How many grandmothers have had experiences with these diseases? You know? It's getting harder for us to find the anecdotes about the natural diseases to counter the anecdotes about the adverse reactions to the vaccines. That's what we're dealing with. So when we're talking about risk, we've got some problems. And that's the reality of our communication. And that's why it's getting harder and harder. And yes, we can borrow from other countries and talk about what's out there, and we can talk about imported cases and what that could do to us. But as long as our vaccination rates stay well above 90% for most of these diseases, we're going to have a challenge. And that's a good thing, and it's a bad thing. but it's where we are. When we have crises in our field, a vaccine recall, a vaccine safety issue that pops up, we do have to respond in some way in our communication. It's best if we respond collectively together and we have a consistent message. But our organizations, who we are and how we respond, is going to make a difference. Our reputations are going to make a difference. How we are conducting ourselves on a day-to-day basis is going to make a difference. So it's not just how we communicate in the moment when the crisis occurs, whatever it is. It's how we're communicating all the time. It's how accessible we are with honest and open communication. And that changes over time. So we have to be constantly aware of who we are and how we're communicating. If we've had high-profile events in the past in our organization, that will come up again. If we've had missteps along the way in the past, all of that bad history will pop back up again. They're not going to let us forget it. So understand that that will be revisited. We do understand in our research at CDC, anytime that we start to look at the issue of trust and communication around sensitive issues and threats, that all of our research indicates that the public trusts their local health care providers most, their local health departments most. So I think that that's important for you to understand how critical it is for that relationship to be maintained in an honest and open way. So there's no one at the national level that is going to be the critical caretaker in terms of trust around vaccination issues. The real trust and the real messenger around these issues are at the local level. So keep that in mind. That's really where the power exists in this communication. It is those local relationships that have the power in this mission around vaccination. The local healthcare provider, the local health department, those spokespersons have the relationships and the trust most important. Who we're talking to and how they, what they perceive is important in a crisis situation. People will act on the information that they have. So what does that mean? Well, it means we need to make sure they have the information that's good information to act on, doesn't it? Which means that we have to be able to anticipate the kind of information that they will need. And sometimes I think we chase our tails, not thinking about what is the relevant information in a crisis situation. What's relevant is, do I need to do something? Is my child or my loved one safe? Okay? What action should I take? Are we safe? Those are relevant questions in a crisis situation. If we have made a controversial decision and it's based on some kind of research data, we need to be able to explain it in simple terms. Sometimes I think our science is too complicated and we're not willing to simplify it. And if we can't simplify it, if we can't make it easy enough for us to understand, then we're going to lose our audience and they're going to mistrust us. I always call myself the test dummy at CDC. I insist that the docs make it simple enough for me to understand. Okay? And we have to force that along the way. We kind of get lazy at times with our messages. And we use the jargon of science and research and just assume that people will allow us to make decisions for them and not give them the information in a way that they can easily digest it. And it's not fair, and they will reject our decisions, especially if they seem controversial. if we can't explain it to them in ways that they can understand it. Theoretical risks. All of the research around risk communication tells us that people don't like theoretical risk. They don't understand what that means. When you cop out, because, you know, oftentimes scientists are not willing to say you're either in or you're out, it's either up or down, you know. So they always leave open the theoretical risk, the idea of theoretical risk. People prefer to have risks stated to them in whole numbers, that there's a 1 in 10 chance, a 1 in a million chance, that kind of thing. But if you can't get to that number and you say there's a theoretical risk, people don't understand what that really means, and they don't like it. So they reject that concept of the theoretical risk. And if we start to throw around statistics too much, and we're not consistent in the way we use statistics, and, you know, you start using adverse risk, and then we use odds ratios, and, you know, I've had my share of biostatistics, believe me, and I forget it as fast as I learn it. I cannot tell you how many different classes in biostatistics, and, oh, yes, I've even taken advanced inferential statistics. Don't ask me. I don't even know anymore what that was, but I did it. But as fast as I take it, I forget it. But if you start throwing around the statistics too much, that becomes problematic too. So oftentimes what we need to do to make statistics livable is to tell it in a story, to try to explain it in a way with an example if it's going to hold meaning for people. And that's important in our communication too. It takes a little work up front, and that's kind of tough if you're in the middle of a crisis. But oftentimes in our vaccine world, we have some opportunity to think these things through as we move forward. In a crisis situation, we are apt to make some mistakes, and these are the mistakes that get us in the most trouble. Do any of these look familiar? Yeah. These are the mistakes we also make in other kinds of crisis situations, and I usually can get everybody to raise their hand and identify with some of these. So, mixed messages. Notice I do not have it up here incorrect messages. I have mixed messages. We have to be very careful about the language and terminology that we use when people are seeking new information in a crisis situation where they are feeling threatened, because they are concerned that their child may be at risk in some way, okay? Because we may have some issue around the efficacy of a vaccine or the contamination of a vaccine, and we start throwing around different terms, that will be perceived as a mixed message. People will be confused by that. And if they become confused, they will start to mistrust the message and the messenger. So it's very important that we try very hard to have consistency in the terms that we use. Very important in a crisis situation. Information release late. What gets us in trouble around that? What happens? Right. People will think we're hiding. They'll think we're trying to spin, making up our story. And while we're trying to get our story straight, because after all, we do have to work through our bureaucracies, don't we? There's going to be somebody out there giving them another perspective, and it may be an incorrect perspective, right? So we leave it open for the rumors and myths that then we're going to have to counter, and then the other mistake is we don't counter it in real time. Paternalistic attitudes, that can be a real problem. In the research that I have done around crisis communication, one of the things that we have determined is that people respect the fact that there are experts out there, and they understand and seek expert recommendations. But on top of that, they also want to understand how these experts came to their conclusions and recommendations. People want to be empowered to make decisions. So really what they want to do is pick your brains as experts to hear how you made these good decisions that you made. They want to hear the steps that you took. That is really a daunting task in a crisis situation, but it's worthwhile. If you take the time to explain, because we know this, this, and this, we've concluded that this is the best route to take at this time, goes a long way. If you bypass, because we know this, this, and this, and you just say, we've concluded that this is the right way to go at this time, you have not allowed the people to come along with you in the decision-making process, and it sounds paternalistic to them. You're treating them like children, and they don't like it. It does take a little longer to do it. But by doing it, it actually may shortcut the process because people will feel satisfied. They will understand how you came to that conclusion, and they're going to feel better. And maybe they'll take your recommendation a little more quickly. Otherwise, what are they going to have to do? They're going to have to come back and say, why? Why have you concluded this? And then there's going to be a little bit of a tussle. But if you can make some sense out of your recommendations by allowing them to hear why you've come to this conclusion, it's going to be a little tougher. The communication's going to take a little bit longer up front. But your recommendations might be accepted ultimately. And again, it's tough. You know, you're experts in your field. It may feel like to you that your expertise is being questioned. Don't get defensive in that situation. Share your knowledge. Share your knowledge. And ultimately it will work better for you. There are some things that we can do in a crisis situation to improve our chances of success in our communication. Oh yeah, it's a good idea to have a communication plan. It really is. Work with your communication experts. Being the first source for information. Why is that important? Because the research tells us that in a crisis situation, when people are seeking new information, the very first piece of information they get that makes sense to them, it doesn't have to be correct, but makes sense for them, they will take it in and believe it. And then every other piece of information that they get after that, it will have to bump up against that first piece of information. And so if the first piece of information they get is incorrect, and you have the right piece of information, but you got there late, you're going to have to not only give them your piece of correct information, you're going to have to overcome the piece of first information they got that was incorrect. So it's just in our best interest, as fast as we can, to get the correct piece of information out to people. And oh, by the way, what we do know is that the speed at which you communicate to the public in a crisis is a marker for your preparedness. They believe that you are prepared to manage an issue the more quickly you communicate to them in that crisis. So what does that do? That elevates your credibility and their trust in you. So that's another reason to be the first source for information. Speed counts. I know. I belong to a bureaucracy too. I'm fighting it every day. Okay. My nifty little book in Crisis and Emergency Risk Communication, when I wrote the chapter about clearance, I went for what is right, not the reality I live in. You know? And I stand up there when I train, and I preach it the way I know it should be. And I'm hoping there's enough young people in my organization that sometime they will rise up and they will fight the system enough that we will get things cleared and out the way it's supposed to be, okay? And in enough numbers, we might be able to do that someday. So let's bring it out in your organization too. There's a reason that we have to be out there first. There are good reasons why we need to be. And we have to attune to that and work for that. Because if we don't, we leave those first messages to people who may not have the public's best interest at heart. And that's a good enough reason for me to fight it. Okay, now I'm getting close enough to retirement, I can fight it. Yeah. Express empathy early. If there's one concept I want you to leave with this morning, it is that concept. Empathy. Empathy. All the research tells us in a crisis situation, when people are feeling threatened, when their loved ones are threatened, they need to hear empathy from the people who are there to respond to that crisis event. And empathy is simply the ability to express in words that you understand what they are feeling, that you can put yourself in their shoes. And I will guarantee you, well, to the point that there are no sociopaths in this room, that everyone in this room has the innate ability to express empathy. The research tells us that you are born with the ability to express empathy. To express it means to put into words the emotion that people are feeling. I understand you're anxious, you're frustrated, you're frightened, you're concerned, you're angry. Whatever those emotions are, when you express empathy, you express it to the people you're talking to who have the feeling. Okay? You're not expressing it about people. And there's a difference between empathy and sympathy. Sympathy is our hearts go out to the victims. That's a sympathy statement. That's not empathy. Empathy is saying to the people who are feeling the emotion, I understand how frustrating this is. I understand that at this moment we don't have answers, and this uncertainty is causing a great deal of anxiety for us at this time. That's an expression of empathy. If we can express empathy early on in a crisis situation, people will be open to us. This is what the research tells us. In a crisis situation, when people are threatened, there's a psychological barrier that goes up. And what happens is this little message goes in their mind. When the official shows up to talk about it, this thing goes on. It says in the person's mind, do they get it? Do these people get it? Do they understand how frightening this is? How concerned I am? I didn't think this could happen to me. Do they get it? And until you express empathy, till you let them know, yes, I get it. I understand. Until you do that, they can't hear you. Because they just got that thing looping in their head. Express, I get it, I understand. Then it will quiet down that tape that's going on in their head, and they'll hear you. So take a moment to express that empathy. Empathy builds trust. It builds a connection, a human connection. Express empathy. It's okay. It's okay. You can be an official. You can be a professional and express empathy in a situation. It boosts your communication success. Competence and expertise. Y'all, we get a break on that. This is what the research tells us, that they will believe you're competent until you prove otherwise. Isn't that cool? Yeah. Okay, so all we have to do is just show up and be competent. We don't have to show them our CV. You know, we don't have to tell them about all the wonderful successes we've had in the past. We just have to continue to be successful. So, and honest and open. I wish we had, you know, the whole day to spend to talk about what it means to be honest and open. But we don't. And I will tell you that this is the lesson I use for being honest and open. Because more often than not, when we are in a crisis situation, we start holding back information. We usually use the excuse, well, if we start to tell people that information, they'll panic. No, people won't panic. Because, you know, I have never sat in a meeting where somebody has given us around the table or in the conference room a piece of information that we don't want to tell the public because they'll panic. I have never seen the people around the table jump up and start pulling their hair out and panicking. So I don't know what's so different about those of us around the conference table from the people out there in the public, because we're not panicking, so why do we think everybody else is going to be panicking? You know, I have yet to figure that out. But one time on a Friday afternoon, there was a little crisis going on. Have you ever noticed they're always on a Friday afternoon? I swear. I think we could do a statistical study on that. Okay? Yeah, exactly. All the outbreaks. Anyway, so I was on this conference call. Now, I'm just the communicator. I don't have to make any of the decisions. I just have to write up whatever decisions are being made because I got to put out the press release. And they were trying to decide whether they were going to recall product, not vaccines. And there were just all these, you know, public federal agencies on this call and some state health officials and whatever. And the call was going on and on and on. I'm thinking, come on, y'all, I got to get out this press release if we're going to recall this product. And finally, this one state health official just... he was wonderful because he really cut to the chase. He just said, well, come on, we got to make a decision here. Let's get to it. I mean, after all, here's the bottom line. Are any of you going to let your mom tomorrow morning eat these Toastios? Well, the decision was made. And I've thought about it ever since then. I think that that's the answer. When we're talking about withholding information, now, are you going to go out of this meeting room and call your mom and give her that information? And if you are, then why aren't we telling everybody's mom? Right? Okay. Enough said. We can keep going. In crisis situations, probably the toughest thing we have to deal with is uncertainty. People will seek any information to reduce uncertainty. That means they will seek incorrect information. That is our biggest challenge. They want to make a decision. What we will have to do is acknowledge the anxiety of uncertainty and tell people to hold off, to wait with us, that we have a process in place to work toward trying to reduce the uncertainty and get information. We may even have to acknowledge that we may never have the answer. That's a tough one, isn't it? Honest and open. Don't overpromise and underdeliver. One of the things that we do know is that you can give people things to do to reduce anxiety. Anytime we have an action step for people in a crisis situation, that's a good thing. Think up of things for people to do. And believe it or not, even symbolic actions, even the idea of seeking out more information makes people feel better. Give people things to do, and they will feel better. Include them in the process of responding to the crisis. Direct them in some way, and they will feel better. We know that when people are given complex information in a crisis, they will simplify it. That means that we need to simplify the information we give them, because when they simplify, they may simplify it incorrectly. And they will cling to their current beliefs. In fact, beliefs become stronger, including cultural beliefs. So be careful about that. I told you that that first messages carry more weight. I also know that we limit the intake of new information in a crisis situation. We just can't take in a lot of information. So that means if we are going to tell people new information, that message has to be simple. It needs to probably be, if we want people to do something or take in new actions, that we should side on probably only three things. If you want really people to take in the information in a crisis, probably no more than three pieces of new information is the right thing to do. Let me ask you, some of us have been out of first grade longer than others, but do you remember what you may have been taught by a guest visitor in first grade, what you should do in case your clothes started on fire? Perfect. I wish all of our crises we could come up with that perfect kind of, you know. Now, don't make up a third thing for people to do if you don't have a third thing, but, you know, if you can limit Your directions for people in a crisis to just three simple things for them to remember really get down to a simple message. That's an ideal thing in a crisis situation. I want to make a distinction between communicating to stakeholders and partners. Our stakeholders are people who think we're beholden to them in some way for information. They may not be our friends, but they still think that we should communicate to them. That means that in our planning for crisis events, and Lord knows, we have them, don't we, around the vaccine issues. So we need to plan ahead of time. Who are people who think that we owe them special communication? When we were managing the retrospective study at CDC, which was the largest ever, around the Rotashield vaccine, when we were looking for intussusception, and we had the voluntary recall of Rotashield vaccine. Well, one of our stakeholders, of course, were those organizations organized around, and I'm sorry, because I don't know how to talk about them, and for lack of a better way to describe them, those organizations that were, quote, anti-vaccine, and I know they don't characterize themselves as anti-vaccine, but that's the way I thought of them as I was categorizing them. I organized my communication outreach to them in advance of our launching all of this because I knew that they thought of their relationship with us as special, unique from the general public. And so as we were launching our media outreach, I also had communication outreach going specific to these organizations, and we told them exactly what we had going on, why we were doing it, what we knew, where we were going with this, and why we were doing it, and told them what avenues of communication were open to them to continue to stay in touch with us as we went through this. And Rotashield vaccine recall is not big on your minds as one of the worst events that occurred around immunization. And I do believe to this day, because we did have deaths associated with intussusception, we did have illness and hospitalizations associated with Rotashield vaccine. And I think that one of the reasons we did well is because we were willing to talk to a stakeholder group that maybe would have otherwise been ignored if we didn't understand the importance of reaching out to all stakeholder groups, advocates, adversaries, whatever, it didn't matter, because I understood that they believed they had a relationship with us and that we needed to tell them specifically, and we showed respect in that relationship and communicated to them. Partners are, of course, the people who we work with traditionally. And we also needed to reach out to them and tell them what we were going to do in that situation. Dealing with angry people. Oh, you didn't think I was going to leave that out of this equation, did you? No. And I'm going to go through this very quickly because I want to open it up for questions if you have questions. And we're running out of time. I'm sorry. There is legitimate anger in situations. People become angry for lots of different reasons. I would say most of the time it's because they feel threatened by a risk that's outside of their control. And some people just naturally become angered by that. And I also think because they feel that they're not being respected and that their fundamental beliefs are being challenged in some way. So that's part of it. But you see the second set of bullets there? That's in play too, isn't it? So we're not going to be able to manage all of the kind of anger that we see out there. I have been in town hall meetings and in situations where I've literally seen the level of rhetoric and the emotions and angers go up the minute that the red light on the camera turned on. Okay? I know the difference, and so do you. So we are going to work at trying to minimize legitimate anger and ignore that kind of anger that has nothing to do with the real dialogue between us. I attended a class at MIT Harvard that was dealing with conflict, and they said that it from interpersonal conflict all the way up to wars between nations, world wars, These are the reasons that people have conflict. And ever since I was taught that, I have applied it to every situation. I don't care if it's road rage. I have been able to see these elements come to play in it. So take a breath and think about that. Think about it in your own situation, because you're probably feeling some of these things also when you're trying to do the good fight and you're feeling oppressed and challenged and attacked yourself in the situation. Because it's not going to do us any good to escalate the conflict. Here's where it really gets messy, is that sometimes we're finding this is when conflict becomes really distorted in some way. I think when it becomes really difficult is number four. When the fight becomes the identity of an individual. And I saw that happening in some of the movements that I was dealing with around vaccine issues. Okay? I told you I didn't come here with the answers. I'm just telling you some of the explanations that I see for why our challenges are where they are. These are some of the ways that we can reduce legitimate anger. When people are feeling threatened, when they feel disrespected, when they feel like things are out of their control, when they think that their cultural beliefs are being challenged. And acknowledge emotions. I think that that's probably one of the underlying themes for me in this, is that we have to understand in a crisis event, when people are feeling threatened, when they feel that their loved ones are being threatened, that it's not just information and science, it's also emotion. And that's where the empathy comes in. That's where taking the other person's perspective becomes so important. Because we are talking about emotional events, not just factual events anymore. And we live, eat, breathe this as a public health imperative. And we have taken this in and fully understand it from a public health perspective, why it is so important that children be vaccinated. But from an individual level, it is a different perspective. And the facts are not as readily available to individuals, and it won't go into them if we can't manage the emotional aspects of this also, especially when a crisis occurs. I think that consider the history of the dispute is really important. I find when I'm talking to people who may be new to the immunization world that they need to understand, especially those organizations who have been at us for a long time, where they've come from and what their perspective is. I'm surprised when I'm talking to people that they don't always know everything that has gone on before us. They may not understand the explosion of the immunization schedule that has occurred and how it occurred. It is important to understand what has happened. In the time that I have been at CDC, what I have seen. This business has changed a great deal in 20 years. A great deal. It's important for us to be able to recognize what has gone on. This third bullet was more for those of us at CDC, but that I caution our people that there's a difference between decision makers and the technical advisors, and that we need to know our roles. That's not as critical to you all. Trust, we've talked a little bit about that along the way. I think the most important thing about the consequences of mistrust is that we're not going to get to do what we really want to do, which is to protect those babies, children, old people, and yes, those adults in the middle. I guess we got to worry about them too, don't we? I love those old people. Research all the way back from Aristotle up to today say these are the elements that build trust. Expressed empathy. Ah, did you see that? Aristotle even says that. Isn't that cool? How do we act trustworthy? We share information early. Third party validators and advocates are important. Okay, I'm not going to do this. I want to do these next two slides, and then I'm going to open it up to questions. I'm really sorry that we don't have more time. These are principles from crisis and emergency risk communication that apply to events that occur in the vaccine arena also. Be first with your information. Give facts in increments as you get them, and be credible, which means tell the truth. Express empathy, give people things to do, and always show respect. And if you can do those things in a crisis event, you will have a successful communication experience. I'll tell you, it won't make the controversy go away, but it will build trust, especially at the local level where it is most important. You already have good credibility with the people in your community. So. You've gone a long way in that. This is a website where the Crisis and Emergency Risk Communication course is taught online. You can get CEU and CHES credits. And the CERC request at cdc.gov is a place where you can get CERC materials that can expand on what I've talked about. The slides. Are you guys offering the slides? From these, okay, so you've got the presentation from this, but other, and you can reach me if you have additional questions that we're not able to touch upon today. I care deeply about the topic that we're talking about. I'm frustrated that I don't have more time to talk to all of you in depth. I've just sort of skimmed across a lot of different concepts in this. I teach this from as much as a two-day course to a four-hour course, so to try to jam it into 45 minutes is a little tough. But if you have any specific questions this morning, I'd be happy to try to tackle them in the little time that we have left.
Why don't we thank Barbara for
it? Thank you right back.
Thank you so much. I think this is a really such an important area. I'd like to bring up the recent Georgia autism case and talk about it from a local perspective, because on the one hand, what we have is very articulate parents, mm-hmm. Very open parents. We've got HRSA and CDC saying we can't really talk about a specific case. I think it's a nuance that HRSA and CDC are different to the general public because they see them as arms of the Fed. And at a local level, we want to be first. We want to be accurate. Yes. We want to have the facts. And we don't have any facts.
Right.
And we want to respond. But what do we have in our sort of Rolodex? We've got epidemiologic studies from 10 years ago. We've got metabolism studies from last week. We've got thimerosal and autism studies from last month. We don't have the facts about this case. We can't. How do we respond? How would you suggest we respond in that sort of situation?
You're in a terrible spot, and we all felt handcuffed in that situation because we were dealing with a legal issue, and in fact, we're still dealing with an ongoing legal issue. We're also dealing with legal issues in a companion case around TB and the Andrew Speaker thing, and we're being told what we can and can't say around it. So it's not only in the vaccine world that we find ourselves when we're dealing with legal issues that we're handcuffed in what we can and can't say. From the local perspective, you know what you just said here was honest and open, and it was, we wish we had more that we could say. there's, you know, what we have is not adequate. We wish we had more that we could say at this point around this. And what I would say is there's some things that we don't have to tell you at this point that we wish we could. And my perspective on this would be to just speak honestly to the community and say, here's what we know now. This case brings up some questions, and we don't necessarily have answers to all these questions at this point. As I watched it unfold 2 weeks ago in the media, and we weren't first either on this one, because we were being told that we couldn't say anything, even though it leaked, and then they came out publicly, and you know, they were on Larry King and other things. The only saving grace of it was that they didn't come out 100% against vaccination, which was helpful to us in that regard. And I think that was probably the one thing that saved us. But I would just say, you know, we also don't have the facts of this case. Can we address your specific concerns? And if we can, we'll answer your specific concerns to the extent that our science and research is able to. And I think that we have to be a little humble in what our research does and doesn't tell us along the way. And acknowledge to parents that they are making important decisions for their children, and that we want to help them make good decisions for their parent for their children along the way. So instead of trying to answer every question on a scientific level, try to answer the question on a more human level by acknowledging what we know and what we don't know. I know that's not a perfect answer, but I think a parent would relate to that, and maybe from a professional level that's hard to do, but I think that the public would relate to that. And it's not something that really works well on a website, but it does work well if you're talking directly to parents. I know it would work well. It's inadequate, but it's the best that we have at times. I would need a more specific question from a parent to be able to answer that more.
I'd like to say that I really loved your presentation.
Thank you.
And one of the things that has occurred to me during the time I've been sitting here, after inheriting a group of individuals who suffer from that syndrome, of all of these things have happened to the internal staff, is that how do you go back when it's not only the message that's being delivered to the outside community, but the internal staff has a lot of, are people too.
Yes.
And they have a lot of these same frustrations and
yes.
a lot of these feelings that when you inherit a group of individuals, it's a cumulative piece. And so you're on the end of the iceberg. How do you go back to start it, to deliver the message
Can
out?
Can I speak honestly to you? And the rest of you don't have to pay attention. I've been at CDC now, like I said, for almost 20 years. I guess I'm stretching it to say 20 years, but it feels like it. And I have been around this issue for a long time. There's so much frustration among our own group. There's rifts among us, and some people want to hear it and some people don't. Some people have become very rigid in their thinking, and they're not open to any discussion of putting yourself in somebody else's shoes. And people are hurt. They feel abused. This is hell for so many people that I don't know what you can do. I think we have to show the same empathy to our own staff as I'm asking that we show to the parents who are struggling with these decisions in this swirl of controversy that exists out there. But the controversy exists because the threat of the disease doesn't exist, and that's part of the problem. Well, No, it's part of the success. You know, I mean, and that's the problem. And we just go back and forth, and it's so troublesome. But all we can do is just be kind to each other in this process and understand why people have come the way they have. I now have people at CDC who think I'm a traitor because I talk the way I talk about this process and asking us to be a little kinder in the way we approach those organizations who are angry at us and the parents who doubt us and that sort of thing. So it's hard to even sometimes bring this up to touch it. But we can't stop, you know? I mean, we can't just take our bat and ball and go home and say, oh, we're not going to do immunizations anymore, are we? So I don't know. I mean, but I'm glad you got something from this, and if you can take any of these concepts and share them internally and you think it will make someone feel a little better, I'd say try it.
Thank you. And I obviously we don't have the presentation yet, so I think a lot of us are dying to get our hands on that. But did you say you wrote a book additionally?
Yeah, it's not specific to vaccines, but it's about crisis and emergency risk communication. And if you go to the online course, you will hear me talk about the issue of empathy and why it's important. I mean, videos, you know, and that sort of thing. Yes. But understand, I learned what I'm applying in this new course around all crises from my experiences in vaccines. So it's because of this and what you've all suffered that I'm using this in a broader context, so it all applies to what's going on here.
Thank you.
Uh-huh. Good morning.
Morning.
I'm a registered nurse from the Virgin Islands, St. Croix.
Ah, been there. Taught there.
Wonderful. I've been a registered nurse since 1973, and I'm a head nurse for the Department of Health Immunization Program. Mm-hmm. And what I want to state is, in my clinic, I use pictures of polio victims, of hepatitis B victims. I think a picture's worth 1,000 words,
mm-hmm.
Even chickenpox, because, mm-hmm. like you say, people are more afraid of the vaccines now than they are of the diseases themselves. And they don't know these diseases.
Right.
And as they're in my waiting room, my waiting area, they get to observe these pictures.
Interesting.
And I love it for the exempt people. I make them wait. I make them wait in my waiting area and observe my pictures.
Could you pipe in the sound of whooping cough? Awesome.
Well, we do have a VCR TV. It's not connected to a cable.
Mm-hmm.
But, of course, there's no more VCRs anymore, so
yeah.
I don't have a DVD in my office, so I can't play these DVDs that come out with these kids that have these whooping coughs and stuff like that, because I played in I would play it in my waiting room. But honestly, a picture is worth, and it's something I say time and time again, a picture is worth 1,000 words.
Well, let me reinforce that for you, that the research tells us that when that a threat in the primitive part of the brain is our emotion and sensing, and that images speak to the primitive part of our brain where the threat occurs. So pictures are do speak to the threat part of our brain, so that the pictures are more effective than words.
Right.
And so you're working
and
it.
And it's simplified.
Yeah. Yeah,
and that's
sure
where, and I'm saying that all the time.
Yeah.
You know, just give it to me.
But there was a decision at some point along the way in health communication that threat and fear was not an effective way to move people to action. However, I can tell you in my research that the threat has to be real to create action in people. And that's why I talk about denial in my training, because when I'm trying to get people to prepare for pandemic influenza, they're not going to until they believe that the threat is real, which is a constant challenge in preparedness world. So you're right.
My mom had polio.
Mm-hmm.
And even though we do get over these diseases, we're left with complexes.
Yes.
And my mom, God bless her, is 87 years old, and to this day believes that everybody's watching her whenever she's walking in a grocery store
right.
with her limp.
Right.
So even though we get over these diseases,
right.
The inferiority complexes that go with them,
right.
And other disorders, personality disorders that come with them, chickenpox that deforms a beautiful
right.
girl's
right.
young face,
right.
The things that you know that these diseases leave them. Even though we get past, they survive.
Right.
We're left. They're often left with disparities, you know, and that they have to live with for the rest of their life.
Right.
And it affects not just them, but their families and so
right.
on. So I'm so into immunization.
Me too.
And,
me too.
Thank yeah. you.
Thank you.
I enjoyed your speech.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Can we just thank Barbara one more time for a great presentation?